The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
In a packed show today, big, big questions. Euro 2012, the final 16. Who's hot, who's not, and who's in which pot? Meanwhile, on the subject of pots, if one calls the kettle black, should they just shake hands about it? Or did Sepp really say, I didn't say, players should just shake hands, but actually go walk past the first bit? In other news, Premier League weekend ahoy. Naming rights derby as Sports Direct United visit the Etihad, Norwich Arsenal and Man United at Swansea's Liberty Ground. A place like Blatter's Mouth, you'll often find defeat. And quality clashes at the wrong end of the table too. Abroad, big games there. Sid's in Spain talking about Valencia against Real Madrid. There's Post, Tweet and Leander Scherlachans on the MLS final. Plus, because you demanded it this once only, the sound of producer Ben's voice. All of that, all of it. Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. The panel includes John Ashdown.
Hello.
Hi, John. Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
And Amy Lawrence.
Hello.
Hello, Amy. Now, much to discuss for us today. There's all that club football, but also, of course, the final word on the qualifying for Euro 2012. Plus, they've selected which team is in which pot. I don't know why they just didn't go ahead and do the draw. But anyway, top pot is Poland, Ukraine, Spain and the Netherlands, which is all very interesting. And more on the Spanish in a bit. And then in the next tier down, so it's one team from each pot. You know how this works. You've got the Germans, Italy, England and Russia. You've been drawing lines on a piece of paper, John. What do these lines tell you about how this might pan out for England?
Well, you've got, the ideal scenario for England is they get one of Ukraine and Poland from the first pot. Probably Greece or Sweden, considering they were pretty poor the other night, from pot three. And then they probably take the Republic of Ireland from pot four, I imagine.
Oh, really?
So you could end up with a Poland, England, Greece, ROI.
Right.
Group, or you could end up with Spain, Portugal and France.
Yes, you could, couldn't you? So basically, pot three is Croatia, Greece, Sweden and Portugal. And then the last group is Denmark and France, the Czechs and Ireland. England against Sweden, of course, took place on Tuesday to the delight of viewers everywhere. Interesting stat that Mike Adamson was tweeting, that England passing the ball back to the keeper. Only one team did this more regularly in Euro 2012 qualifiers, Liechtenstein. What did you make of the? What did you make of England, Sweden?
England, Sweden. I had half an eye on it. It was
right.
Looked very, very dull.
Right.
But I mean, on that point, I was at the Spain game, and you know, during the first 15 minutes with my mate, I was counting the amount of passes England managed to put together. I don't think they put together more than three, so you can see why they pass back to the goalkeeper all the time. They should just be really defensive and stoke it out.
Right. Well, there you go. So that's England's potential nightmare and indeed dream scenarios. What about the Irish and who finished off their qualifying with that? Was it a 1-1 draw at Lansdowne Road?
It was a 1-1 draw at Lansdowne Road. And I think enormous credit has to go to Trapattoni because he's really created this team. And they couldn't have probably, I think, negotiated the whole qualification process more efficiently. I mean, there were a few games that one or two fans probably look back on and cringe for not being tremendously exciting to watch along the way, but results-wise, I think, considering they've had a fair amount of trouble in qualification in recent years, it all seemed like fairly plain sailing and stress-free, which they seem like a very, very well-organised team who have got a great spirit, and which is exactly what you expect from Republic of Ireland, but congratulations for Trapattoni for putting that together because, you know, early on in his reign, not everybody was convinced he was worth a big salary and that he was the right man.
Interview with him, the Gazetta, Filippo Migliarici, a journalist, tweeting, Trapp explaining his, to some, unambitious philosophy. He says, if a man falls while walking, he can get hurt, but if he falls while flying, he'll die. Very interesting. There you go. Now, I mentioned Portugal in Group 3 there, and that's one of the teams that you would count as an England nightmare scenario, John Ashton. You were one of the lucky few to actually witness their 6-2 hammering of Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yeah, and the second half in
particular. How did you do that? Because it wasn't on any legal outlet tonight.
No, I watched it with Portuguese commentary on a dodgy, scrapey internet feed.
All right.
After the England game, and they were excellent. I mean, you just sort of you look at the side, you know, with Contrao, Ronaldo, Nani, Mireles. They've got some really good players. It's sort of strange that they were even in the playoffs. I suppose they had a tough group with Denmark, I think, topped it, didn't they? And they lost in Copenhagen. But they're individually they're a fine side, and they're definitely the one to avoid from pot three, from England's point. Mind you, having watched the Spain game and the Sweden game, you almost think that England would be better off against sides that are better than them, because they can just allow themselves to play in the way they played against Spain, which is actually I thought they played better against Spain in terms of the pattern and the way that they sort of structured themselves than they did against.
So you're actually suggesting that the nightmare group might actually
a weird way, possibly. Yeah. It'd make them look better in that group, because
don't they want to save Portugal for the quarterfinals though?
Possibly, yeah.
So the traditional.
But if you imagine what England would look like playing Greece. How bad England would look doing that, but
they look bad against anybody.
Well, they didn't look great against Spain, but they defended perfectly well.
Yeah, they defended in a friendly,
which they wouldn't be able to do against Greece. They'd be sort of doing the same thing as they did against Sweden.
Are Portugal really that good, though, John? I mean, obviously that result was a bit skew-iff because of the sending off and so on. And in a way, you felt like Bosnia should come and join the Premier League with one of those sort of late collapses that famously everyone's being on the end of at the moment.
But. Was it a good team performance, John?
From Portugal?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, as Amy's right, the second half, Bosnia were pushing forward and they were down to 10 men and had sort of moved their structure around that somehow managed to create massive spaces for all of Portugal's attacking players. But in the way that, I mean, Portugal could have had a couple more, you know, in the final 10 minutes as well. I mean, it could have been really, really embarrassing for Bosnia. I mean, over the two legs, I think it was closer perhaps than 6-2 might suggest.
Because it was 3-2, so wasn't it?
Sort of midway through the second half it was 3-2, and then things started sort of breaking down a little bit more.
Did you see Nani's goal?
Yeah, it was fantastic, yeah. And that's the thing, though, they have got players that can do that. I think that's probably why, you know, if it clicks, they're a threat, I reckon.
Mm. Well, France also in that bottom group. I don't know if you've seen that David Ginola is now threatening to sue Gerard Houllier. Why is this, Amy?
This is a long story that dates back to the World Cup qualifiers for 1994. It was in 1993, exactly. France had
They're still going on about that.
Yeah, France
had
to.
I think it's because he's just repeated the allegations in a book. It's all about a misplaced past.
Yeah, yeah. In a nutshell, France had two home games to wrap up qualification against teams that they were expected to beat, Israel and Bulgaria. And they managed not to beat Israel in the first one, which was a bit of a shock, but they still had the Bulgaria one to sew things up. And they were drawing with a minute to go, and David Ginola had possession in a comfortable attacking area and played some ambitious cross to the far post where nobody was there, and Bulgaria duly broke and Emil Kostadinov scored. At which point France were out, Bulgaria through, and Gerard Houllier, as pretty much only he can, managed to blame everybody in the world and make sure that
specifically
it was nothing to do
Ginola,
with him.
He
picked out Ginola, who was the one who gave the ball away, and
now almost
was
2 decades later.
Yeah, was bandying around words like crime and criminal, as if he'd committed some kind of, you know, quite serious, heinous offence.
Right.
And there were other French players that could have perhaps contributed to this not being a goal. However, it was pretty much universally accepted that Ginola was the man for the guillotine on this particular moment. And I remember speaking to Ginola about it some years ago, and even then it was still ages from the original incident, and he was still pretty cheesed off that he was finger-pointed individually. And they've obviously never got along since. But it's just a recent book in France has brought it back up. And
right.
Ginola has responded with legal action.
All right. Well, another exciting story of legal action on the way in part three today. So that's something to listen out for. But, of course, the team that I think has really impressed people this midweek has been the Germans. That 3-0 victory. It was 3-0, wasn't it?
It was 3-0, well done.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, over Holland.
Yeah, brilliant performance. Some really, really great team goals. Just they're so quick, and they just cut through teams. It's just the third goal, when Klose was 6 yards out and still played another pass to Ozil, it was for a tap-in. And they've closed the gap on Spain, you'd have to think, at the moment, and quite possibly becoming the favourites for Euro 2012.
Well, I think a lot of people would say that they are maybe now the favourites. The Dutch cut down to size, certainly in that game. A little bit of Dutch reaction to that in my Europaper review. But there you go, yeah, Germany. Who would be your favourite, do you think, John?
I think Germany yeah. will win it, yeah.
Have you got a dark horse there?
Ooh, dark horse.
Because you wrote all those lines and numbers and stuff.
They're all relating to the Premier League.
Are they?
This is all my preview stuff. The only thing I've got here is a list of countries who have qualified. Right, dark horses.
Good. Yeah.
England.
Really?
No, of course not. It's not a tournament for dark horses. It's a tournament for a team that coalesces, is that the word I mean?
Possibly it is. Right at the last minute, a la Denmark, a la Greece, and sweeps all before them on its way to victory. Who do you think, Amy?
Ireland. No.
Yeah, it could be. Stranger things have happened.
I think, just going back to Germany and them trying to close the gap on Spain, it's interesting that the last two tournaments, it's been against Spain where they've actually been knocked out and not quite managed to, if you like, make the final hurdle. But definitely you feel like they're readier than ever to give Spain a much closer game and a much tougher challenge.
Mm.
And I think, you know, it seems idiotic at this stage to be talking about dream finals, but yeah. It's definitely the one I'd want to see.
All right.
Paul Dore made an interesting point as well, comparing Germany and Spain on Tuesday, when he said that everyone's going to park the bus against Spain. And they don't have any strikers at the moment who are in form. Whereas Germany, if teams do that, then they have strikers who they can put the ball in the box, like Klose and Gomez, and score.
You can't park the bus against the Germans?
No. Right. That's what he was saying.
Problem is, they could be drawn in the same group, of course, because they're in different pots.
That would be an interesting group, wouldn't it?
Although that would keep them apart. If they both went through, that would keep them apart for the final,
if
I guess.
If they went through. Yeah. You think someone's going to go through at the expense of this?
Well, it might be an England group, Amy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the Spanish, eh? I wonder what their take is on what's been a fairly difficult week for the Iberians. A defeat to England, of course, in that 2-2 draw in Costa Rica. Let's dial up Sid Lowe for news on that and a little bit more. Where are you, Sid?
I'm in Madrid.
Yeah, but there's kind of noises and stuff going on in the background.
Oh, no, I've just walked into an office to try and steal a newspaper off someone.
All right. Okay.
Unfortunately, they haven't got the one I wanted. So,
which one did you want and why, Sid?
I wanted Marca, and I'm stuck with Ass, but I don't think there's a huge difference.
All right. I hope you get some Ass later on then.
Hey. Well, the thing about Ass is there is always an Ass on the back. They do this thing where they on the back cover they always have a picture of an attractive woman, or sometimes not quite so attractive woman. Always with a very, very, very tenuous link to sport to try and justify it. So the back cover today is, let's have a look, Argentinian actress Rocío Marengo, who apparently is a big fan of sport, especially football. it's almost as good as the news in brief.
Yeah. A big fan of yours, not just football specifically, but I'm talking about sport in general. You were mentioning what might happen when Spain went to Costa Rica, and Luke Zalordi, they had the 2-2 draw. They were 2-0 down, were they not?
Yeah, they were, and the response here has been one of Spain were really pretty appalling for a big chunk of the game, and then reacted well, and a bit of pride rescued it. And there is a feeling now that it's problematic that Spain keep losing. Of course, it's all tempered by the fact that these are friendlies, and there's a belief that it will be different when they play competitive games. And I think there's an element of truth in that. But certainly it's a worry. But I think the underlying problem is the one that we touched on briefly on Monday, which is that Spanish players do not enjoy the fact that they're being sent around the world. They do not enjoy it. And the physical demands that's making on them could well have a negative impact between now and the end of the season, because it's a relatively packed season anyway. You know, they've just been halfway around the world to play in Costa Rica and come back again. I know from at least two or three of them that they were struggling with jet lag, that the condition of the pitch wasn't great, and so it's not a particularly good collection of factors.
No, absolutely not. In other news, Madrid this weekend are going to the almost equally exotic Valencia.
Yeah, and in theory at least, this is one of those games you look at it and you think this may be the first time this season where perhaps Madrid aren't favourites. Now, the problem with that theory is that last year Madrid scored 6 in Valencia. Admittedly, by then, I think they knew that the league had gone, and it was at that stage when Ronaldo was battering goals past everybody in a sort of dash to the finish line in terms of the goal-scoring awards, but knowing deep down that Madrid probably wouldn't win the league title. But it certainly is true that Madrid have, over the last year, have slipped up against weaker teams rather than stronger ones. But, of course, as you can imagine, everybody in Spain is talking about the FIFA virus and what impact will this have on Barcelona and Real Madrid. And the likelihood is it will have a relatively big one. Certainly, statistically, immediately after international games, Barcelona struggled quite a lot. Madrid slightly less so. And it's quite an exciting one. But, of course, it comes in the context of a league that even when you've got a third-place team like Valencia, which is a genuinely good side and in patches this season have played some really nice football, they were excellent against Barcelona, for example. Deep down, everybody kind of thinks, yeah, well, it's a great game, but ultimately it probably won't decide anything because Valencia will be a long way off. I mean, Unai Emery, the Valencia coach, even had a letter from supporters last week basically saying, "Dear Unai, we don't much like the way you work."
Because why?
Well, there's a number of ways of looking at this. First one would say because they're extremely ungrateful, Valencia fans. They're the hardest to please of all the fans in La Liga. These are the fans that whistled and booed Rafa Benitez in the season in which he ultimately won the league. They whistled and booed Hector Cooper at a time when Valencia were top, and this was a side that got to 2 Champions League finals. There's a frustration, I think, about the reality, and of course the reality is that this Valencia side cannot compete with Madrid and Barcelona anymore. But I think the way you would perhaps justify it to some extent is that they feel that, all right, we don't expect to be alongside Madrid and Barcelona, but expect to be a little closer, maybe be a bit more exciting in the play, which again I think is perhaps a little bit harsh, but that's really undermining everything. And also the fact that every year Unai Emery gets his contract renewed by Valencia, but every year it always feels like the club themselves are not particularly convinced, which again I think is harsh. I think he's an extremely impressive coach.
Breaking news on Thursday, Sepp Blatter, in his No Racism in Football row, which he subsequently denied, but he was pretty specific about it on both CNN World Sport and Al Jazeera, saying, "I would deny it, there is no racism. There's maybe one of the players towards another. He has a word or a gesture which is not the correct one. But also, the one who is affected by that, he should say, this is a game, we're in a game. And at the end of the game, he should shake hands. And this can happen because we have worked so hard against racism and discrimination." When I had my picture taken next to that nice South African fellow.
It was called what?
Tokyo Sex Swali? Something like that.
Mm.
Anyway, cool. He also said similar things on Al Jazeera. During the match, you may say something to someone who's not looking exactly like you, but at the end of the match, it's forgotten. So come on, people, let's move on, eh? There's been a huge reaction to this in England, with even Robbie Savage saying Blatter must go. But that's not a call that's been echoed worldwide, disappointingly. And is this worse than the other stuff?
Well, there's been so many occasions where you think, well, surely this is it. Surely this is it for Blatter. Enough's enough. But unfortunately, we haven't quite got to the stage where there's a change yet, and much needed change. As David Conn, I think, pointed out, probably the only thing that's going to make the difference is when the money starts being pulled away from FIFA and some of the sponsors decide that they can't really back this nonsense any longer.
The footballers take a stand.
Well, either would be nice. Yeah. Anything as quickly as possible.
Well, several footballers have. Rio Ferdinand, for example.
Well, they're in an argument on Twitter at the moment, Sepp and Rio.
Yep.
Although at the moment, I think Rio was in training, so he hasn't seen Sepp's tweet at him.
See, he tried to sort of make it
look like Rio was being racist.
Yeah.
It was just quite interesting. It's just astonishing that to sort of basically say that footballers have carte blanche to be racist while they're playing football. It's just incredible. I mean, and he won't go, obviously, he won't go over it, but... Oh, it's astonishing, really.
Well, a lot of people say things like, if a player, for example, abuses the referee but then shakes hands with him at the end of the game, is that fine?
Well, according to Sepp, it is, yeah.
Well, all very disturbing, once again, from Sepp Blatter. Yar Dilly Dally, or it might be Jar Dilly Dally, topically enough, tweeting in on the subject of the FA's charges against Luis Suarez. He says, "I expect the FA to throw the book at Suarez. Easier to target Johnny Foreigner than the England captain, John Terry." But he might still face FA charges, no?
Well, yeah, and also there's a police investigation going with John Terry.
Come on, Judge.
There's got to be a bit of lack of club allegiance about this.
Has there?
No. Well, yeah, I mean, last night when it was announced that Suarez had been charged, you get the Liverpool fans saying, oh, it's just because the FA want to suck up to Alex Ferguson. Well, no, because he's been accused of racism.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with him playing for Liverpool or And if he's not, and if he's innocent, then fine. And if he's guilty, then don't, you don't have to back him just because he plays for your club.
Exactly. Fair enough. And it brings us rather nicely on to what for many is the marquee fixture this weekend in the Premier League. Chelsea taking on Liverpool. Liverpool's 3 points behind Chelsea, who are still in these top four positions, but they're stuttering a bit. Only 2 wins in their last 5 games, Chelsea. John, you looked shocked when I threw that stat at you.
No, sorry, I just literally drifted off.
Oh, right.
And then I came back into the room.
You didn't miss anything. But as I was just saying, Chelsea-Liverpool, you know, they're playing this weekend.
I should point out that I didn't literally, I wasn't floating around the pod. I didn't literally drift off. I just drifted off.
It can happen in zero gravity, of course. All sorts of interesting things here. Liverpool won both games against Chelsea last season. But the goal scorers back then were Torres and Morelles, who I hardly need point out, except to you, John, and now play for Chelsea.
Yeah, well, the sort of the international break came at a good time for Chelsea in a way, because they'd had those two back-to-back defeats two back-to-back defeats against QPR and Arsenal, and then they scraped that 1-0 away win at Blackburn. And so it's all a little bit, you know, they weren't in a great deal of form, so perhaps 2 weeks away might sort of help them get their mojo back. Villas-Boas has been in the news this week because he's denied his FA charge for having a go at Chris Foy after the QPR game. I find it amazing that he's denied this charge, because he said afterwards that he admitted he'd been very aggressive towards the referee in his press conference. So, and then to come out and say, no, I'm actually going to contest the charge, seems a bit strange.
Mm. What happens to him if he does get fined?
Well, it's touchline bans and fines and stuff.
Right.
Nothing too exciting.
Okay, Suarez, he is exciting. 4 goals, and we were raving about this last time around. So he certainly comes into this game in great form. Do they have what it takes to win at Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, they won last. I know they had Morelles playing for them last season. Mm. But yeah, they're a better team than they are. When they went to Stamford Bridge last season, they played something like a 3-6-1 formation. They'll be a lot more expansive than that. And they've been better away from home as well this season. When they play at Anfield, they seem to be a bit more cagey, a bit nervous in front of the home fans. They're not so good when teams shut up shop against them. So, yeah, there's to play well on the counter. They've won at Arsenal as well.
Mm.
So, yeah.
All right. What did you make of Stuart Downing, by the way, for England? And the fact that for Liverpool so far, he has no goals and no assists.
Yeah, I saw him burst past the right back and then put in a cross which Rodwell somehow missed.
Right.
3 yards out with an open goal. I didn't realise Stuart Downing could be that quick.
Well, now you know.
Yeah.
City, of course, this weekend start a difficult run of fixtures. They're facing a lot of big teams, starting off with the only other unbeaten side in the Premier League, Newcastle. City were a little bit shaky against QPR in their last Premier League outing. Newcastle, I have to say, they've got some tough games as well, of course. United after this, and then Chelsea back at the Sports Direct Arena. Mm. Any chance for Newcastle at the Etihad?
I think they might get a draw.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, they've got a fantastic defensive record away from home. They've only conceded 3 goals in their 5 games. They've held Arsenal and Tottenham in the 2 games against other sort of leading sides this year, although that was against early season Arsenal. So, yeah, they've got every chance of ending that 100% record of City's.
Really?
I think so. I think they can get a point there, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I think City will win easily. Right, like they do against everybody.
Yeah. They can have a fight.
That's the most likely outcome. Yeah. Right.
Amy?
You think City probably, but yeah. I don't think it's beyond Newcastle to get.
Not beyond Newcastle. Well, if they win that, we might find some room for them on Monday's pod, provisionally. Now, Amy, you've got a trip to East Anglia.
I have.
This weekend, along with your Arsenal chums, they're going to be at Norwich. Arsenal with a 4-match winning streak. They're up to 7th now.
Oh. They've been at 7th for a while, actually, even though they've been winning quite a lot of games. They've been making ground to get closer to the teams in front of them, but they haven't as yet managed to get in front of the sort of the ones, I suppose, they're going to be challenging.
Well, they're
for
in
the
that big glut of teams. There's Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool, and indeed Arsenal. Is it just 3 points separating them?
More or less. I'm not exactly sure, but not.
I'm getting nods from John over there.
Yep. Yeah. He's done some bit more homework than me.
All right.
I've printed out the league table.
How much of a worry are Norwich to Arsenal?
Well, I mean, Norwich have got a good home record, and like a lot of the promoted teams, they've started off quite optimistically. And it's quite often around this time where the promoted teams start to feel a little bit weary, and the wave starts to not be quite so cresty.
Right, yeah.
But having
decrest.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But how concerned are you for, say, Arsenal's backline? Because, you know, Norwich, they've got some They've got some potent fellas. You've got
But I think Arsenal's back line has improved over the last few weeks.
Has it?
And I think Vermaelen coming back makes a big difference.
Right, yeah.
Koscielny has definitely improved a lot, seems to be getting better and better, and by all accounts played quite well for France in the internationals. And the goalkeeper is a great plus. Just, you know, it's still quite a shock, I think, for Arsenal fans to go to matches and not have a heart attack every time there's a ball launched in from a corner or a high ball coming in over the centre halves. I think probably Andre Santos and Jenkinson, who were slight concerns and for different reasons at fullback, seem to be again sort of slowly getting a bit better game by game, as Arsene Wenger always says, game by game. And Alex Song in front is got right back into form, which he was quite shaky when everybody was for Arsenal at the start of the season, and he seems to be very much in control again. And I think that there's a much more solid feel about Arsenal for sure, but yeah, away from home, it can always be a bit more vulnerable.
All right, Spurs have Aston Villa on Monday night. Meanwhile, down at the bottom, all sorts of interesting games. Everyone from Bolton, who are the third last team, up to QPR in 11th, is separated by just 3 points. So it's potentially a very fluid situation in the lower end of the table. And you've got Wigan are playing Blackburn, Fulham against Sunderland, who are both 1 point above the bottom three. So in all sorts of danger there. And West Brom hosting Bolton.
Yeah, well, the international break, speaking of it coming at a good time for Chelsea, came at a very bad time for Bolton, because they hammered Stoke 5-0, didn't they, and would have loved to have just carried
pushed
on playing.
On.
Yeah, get a bit of momentum going. West Brom, they lost a couple back-to-back before the international break, so you could argue it came at a good time for them. And they lost their assistant manager, of course, Michael Appleton, who's gone to Portsmouth. And I think that sort of thing is quite often underestimated in terms of its importance.
The Wilkins effect.
Well, yeah, if you want to call it that, yeah. Mm. I mean, members of, particularly assistant managers, they're important parts of the backroom staff, and it can affect teams. I'm not sure if Roy Hodgson's brought anybody in to replace
him. He said they weren't desperate to replace Mr. Appleton.
That's interesting. Mm. But, it's a tough one for both teams, that, I think.
Man United lost their assistant manager and then won the Champions League in the same season.
Was that manager Carlos Queiroz?
No, Brian Kidd.
Oh, Brian Kidd, right, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, we had Brian Kidd at Bramall Lane for a while. I'm not entirely sure what a loss that was.
Producer Ben, on an unrelated note, asks which team's going to have the most moustaches this weekend for Movember. I actually know the answer to this one, Producer Ben. That answer is Stoke.
That's going to be my guess.
Yeah, Stoke. Me have a guess.
Stoke's my
guess.
It is
Stoke, yeah. The entire squad are growing, facial furniture. The Harry Potters, you might call them. Good. Well, it has to be a moustache, by the way. Not you can't have. They can't connect with you. You know the rules. Yeah, Tony Pulis. I don't know actually if he's going to be on board with the hairy upper lip scenario. I'd like to think he would. That's it for part two. And but coming up in part three, all sorts of drama and excitement. Your posts. Some very interesting dispatches from the wide world of international football. A bit of news from Italy and other stuff too. Now, very exciting. There's somebody posted in, and I'm awfully sorry, I didn't write this one down, but somebody posted in and said, can't we just once hear Producer Ben's voice? And the answer is yes, you can, because aware of the time difference that would hamper our attempts to contact ESPN's Leander Schierlakens for a special preview of the MLS Cup, Houston Dynamos against that LA lot, Galaxy thing, at the Home Depot Center in Los Angeles. Producer Ben went ahead and recorded a preview with him on Wednesday evening, and he started by asking, is America excited?
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt that David Beckham is in there. I think excitement for MLS is growing. I think the league is growing. I think there's more consciousness for it all around. Put it this way, people know that the game is happening, and that's already progress for MLS.
Now, of course, Leander, this is rumoured to be David Beckham's last game in the MLS. Is he going to get the Hollywood ending that his career is absolutely crying out for?
Well, first, you say that it's probably his last game. People seem to think that in Europe, but that isn't at all seen as a given here in the U.S. His Galaxy teammates say they assume that he'll be returning next year. The AIG powerhouse that owns the club seems quite confident that it'll be able to retain him. And David himself has, of course, been mum on the entire thing. But one thing that does seem clear is that he likes to live in L.A. Now, that's not to say London and Paris aren't nice cities to live, but I think he has become more conscious about the impact on his family. Young Brooklyn actually plays in the Los Angeles Galaxy Academy. It seems that they've put down roots in Los Angeles, and I don't know at this stage if how willing he would be to give those up. That said, this is a great opportunity for him, if he does leave, to really end on a high. They're playing a solid team in the Houston Dynamo, but a team they should handily beat if all goes as it should, which would give him, once again, like it did at Manchester United and at Real Madrid, a championship on his way out. That's very possible. I mean, this is a game they should win.
So Houston, clearly the underdogs in this fixture, but who are their danger men? Who should we be looking out for?
The Dynamo have a very good playmaker who in America is often referred to as the left-footed David Beckham, which might be a little exaggerated. His name is Brad Davis. He's injured, however. That said, the Dynamo are a long-running success story in MLS. It's one of the teams that, without spending the sort of money that the Galaxy have on Landon Donovan and David Beckham and Robbie Keane, managed to compete very well. They won championships in 2006 and 2007. Before they moved to Houston, when they were the San Jose Earthquakes, they won two more championships. And they are a solid team all around. It's not going to be a walkover. They won't be pushovers. But they're nevertheless not as good a team as the Galaxy.
Are you going to be so bold as to give us a prediction for the scoreline?
3-1 Galaxy.
All right then, producer Ben. And it's funny because he looks like Barry White. He speaks like that. It's curious, isn't it? Anyway, and Leander Schellekens, thanks very much for that. Very, very excited. I bet you're excited about the MLS Cup, are you? Have you been following it?
I've been vaguely aware.
Vaguely aware of it. Great. That's nice then. All right. There you go. That's MLS Corner. Big games all over the world this weekend, not just in the United States. Bayern against Dortmund. Woof. I bet you're going to be watching that at the Lawrence household. Is that right?
I'd love to watch that.
All right. What about you, Jacob? You haven't really sorted out your weekend's viewing yet, because the other day you came in with your "I've watched 12 hours of football" stuff.
Probably won't be able to do that this weekend.
Will you not? No. Why?
Social plans.
Right, okay, yeah. Okay. Who is she? He's blushing, you. He's blushing. Excellent. John, are you going to be... have you sectioned a little bit of your weekend for a bit of football?
No, I haven't, actually. I turned down a FA Cup first round tie last weekend, so I think I've been punished this weekend by not being sent anywhere. Oh. Although I will be keeping an eye on Leicester Crystal Palace, because it's Nigel Pearson's return to the King Power Walker Stadium.
Right, okay. Rather less glamorously, as I mentioned, there are big games across the continent, including Fiorentina Milan, Delio Rossi, who's now taken over at Fiorentina. And I have a funny feeling that they are going to put a bit of a dent in Milan's fine recent record. Milan have been piling on the goals. I think they won 5 straight, scoring 15 goals in the process. But I think Fiorentina, with Delio Rossi at the helm, I like the look of that. Also, table-topping Lazio are up there with Udinese. They're visiting Napoli, the San Paolo, and that should be a cracking game as well.
How much are Napoli going to take that seriously, though, ahead of the City game next week?
I think they're going to take that seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a big game, of course, in the Champions League coming up. But
they have to win the against City next week.
Well, they're in danger of losing touch with the top three, Napoli, in Serie A. I mean, we're still at a fairly early stage in the season, because Serie A started a little bit later than the others.
Yeah.
But I think that they probably don't think they're going to win the Champions League. I know that Europe's a huge thing for De Laurentiis, but getting back into the Champions League next year is a huge thing as well. Maintaining that level, you know? I don't know. Anyway, another bit of very interesting news, I thought, in Italy, you may have seen, and we discussed this last week, the fact that the criminal trial, the actual police proceedings from the old Calciopoli scandal back in 2006, was finally finished, and it ended up with jail terms for several people, but principally the man who was Juve's director general, Luciano Moggi, who was the head of this shadowy organisation. And you'll recall that back in 2006, in the sporting equivalent of this trial, when the Federation basically handed out penalties. Juve paid the most because they were the worst offenders, and they went down to Serie B. They lost money through that. They lost their Champions League place. They lost their shirt sponsorship, which was the biggest in the world at the time, TV deal, all that massive amount of money. So this week, after the court case in Naples finished with Moggi being given a five-year sentence, Juve said, OK, now we're going to sue for the damages, which we estimate at 440 million euros. Ooh. Who are they suing? Is it Luciano Moggi? No, they're suing the Italian FA. They're suing the Italian FA for 440 million euros because of the fact that they say we were treated unfairly. Yes, our director general was crooked, but you treated us unfairly in your punishment of this because you didn't treat Inter the same way. Now, there's no criminal charges against Inter whatsoever. Juve keeps suggesting there are missing recordings. Some recordings were aired in the criminal trial down in Naples. And when I say recordings, I'm referring to the kind of phone taps of contact between an Inter director and referees, the kind of thing that Juve were up to. But they were deemed as uninfluential to the case. Jacob, I'm losing you, aren't I? You're slumping there in your chair. Anyway, so just to sum this up by saying that Juve then followed up this demand for damages by also requesting to the police in Rome that they remove the head of the Italian FA for basically being incompetent at his job. It's a fascinating league, isn't it? Where, you know, Juve can do this and then happily sail into the weekend's fixtures. And by the way, we're trying to sue the league that we all belong to for 440 million euros.
That's amazing. All right, because there's so much spare cash swilling around in Italy, it's not going to be a problem.
But there's no way they can, surely they won't win that.
Well, I think you're right, John. And it is a bit logic-defying as well, because how can you possibly claim that it was wrong to lose all these things when you've just had your director general? I mean, it's almost James Murdochian in its kind of denial of logic, isn't it? You've just had your director general sent down for this. How can you possibly claim it was unfair? It couldn't be any more bang to rights if they tried.
No.
But anyway, no, it must be. Unless Andrea Agnelli is completely off his trolley, which almost rhymes, intriguingly enough, you might suggest that it's all a bit of a stance that they're doing, either to try and force some sort of concession out of the Federation, because what this is all about is the fact that they want the title back. And more than the money, they want the title back that they feel that they won on the field back in 2006. And instead it was stripped of them, plus the one from the year before when the phone taps were relevant, we're referring to. And that's what I think that they're looking for. They might also be trying to keep the Juve fans sweet. Juve fans are pretty quick to anger, and they have quite a regular habit of building bonfires in the stadium and setting fire to anything that moves and generally causing trouble. And I think that with their new stadium, it might not be a coincidence that they've actually been really, really well behaved so far. I mean, it's also to do with the fact that the team are doing really well. But perhaps the idea of keeping the fans sweet by taking this kind of belligerent attitude over the whole Calciopoli thing is part of the motivation of what otherwise seems an inexplicable move by Juve's directors.
Well, hang on, you're saying they're suing so that their fans won't set fire to their new stadium?
Sorry,
you're losing me a bit there, James.
It's a funny thing. They haven't actually, as far as I know, they've announced they're suing. But you know how it is. I'm going to sue you people. I'm not sure if David Ginola, for example, has actually launched legal action yet, or whether he said, I'm going to sue this person. But people do often bandy around legal actions that don't necessarily take place. But
they can all just shake hands afterwards, surely.
Indeed so. All right. Fingers out of ears all round. The Italy section is over. I'm just going to conclude today's pod with a couple of quick bits of miscellanea. That poor old Grognev bloke who got beaten up, broken nose, broken ribs by people dressed as police, as the reports keep saying, away at Terek Grozny, has received a 6-game ban for his involvement in the incident. They also fined him 50,000 rubles, which sounds like a lot.
He's another one that it should have all been just dealt with by a handshake.
My word. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Well, there you go. I'd love to know why the Russian FA are doing that, but the Russian Players Federation is, as you might imagine, up in arms over that one. Anyway, further updates as they become available. Just to conclude, David DeLarge says, even more brilliant than North Korea being the unofficial world champions. That's true. We talked about Japan, the unofficial world champions. They only went and lost immediately to North Korea. So North Korea are now the unofficial world champions, says David Large. Even more brilliant than that is the prospect of them losing the title to Tajikistan in their next game in February 2012. Good on you, Tajikistan. In the presence of John Wilson, I imagine he'll be there for that game. It's a huge one. And that brings us to an end. of today's Football Weekly Extra. Could it have been any more broad-ranging? No. Thanks, John Ashdown. Thank you, Jacob Steinberg. Thank you, Amy Lawrence, and producer Ben. And most of all, you, the listener. We'll be back on Monday to round up what looks like a terrific weekend of football. There is that European paper review, if you like, on Friday. But for now, we'll sign off and have a super weekend, all of you. Woof.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.